Well, let's not cap this guy's career. Let's not call this the pinnacle. Let's just say this is, I mean, come on.
Of the series.
I mean, he's looking, he don't look that old.
Retirement's right on the precipice.
Welcome to Freely Filtered, the twice-a-month podcast that summarizes and pontificates on recent NEFJC journal clubs. NEFJC is the Twitter Nephrology Journal Club where nephrologists meet in social space to discuss the research and developments that are driving nephrology forward. This podcast is for educational and entertainment purposes only and is not intended to give medical advice. If you have questions about your health, we suggest that you talk with your doctor. This podcast may discuss off-label and unapproved medications. Hello, my name is Joel Toff, Kidney Boy on Twitter. Tonight we have three members of the Filtrate. Swap?
Hey, I'm Swapnil Hirmat. I'm a nephrologist, epidemiologist at the University of Ottawa. I'm on social media as HSwapnil on Twitter, Blue Sky, and Mastodon.
Swap, we've missed you for a while. You took the summer off.
I did take the summer off. My sister was visiting and I was traveling. I went to Banff and the Rockies. Took a real summer vacation.
That sounds amazing. Jordy.
Hi, I'm Jordy Cohen. I'm a nephrologist epidemiologist primarily focused in hypertension research at the University of Pennsylvania. I tweet at Jordy_BC.
And the newest member of the Filtrate, AC, introduce yourself.
Hey, everyone. So I'm AC. I'm a MedPeds nephrology fellow currently at Mass General Brigham and Boston Children's. And I am on the platform formerly known as Twitter at MedPeds Kidneys.
Excellent. And AC, tell me about what you did with Jordy.
This was great.
I didn't know this. This was an awesome story. I love this.
Okay. So I was a medical student and I was like that medical student who was super interested in nephrology, like total dork. And so in a good
way. You meant cool person. Totally cool person.
I was the coolest medical student that you'll ever meet.
You gotta know your audience.
and honestly, I love nephrology because of people like Jordy. So I talked to my division and said, hey, I'm super interested in doing this. I actually want to be a nephrologist one day. Dreams come true, everybody. And so they hooked me up to work with Jordy. And we did a project about medical education and nephrology together for internal medicine residents, which was incredible. So unsurprisingly, I continued to be interested in nephrology and was probably more so interested even after working with Jordy. It was awesome.
And tonight we have a special guest. We have Tim Anderson. Tim, introduce yourself.
Howdy, Tim Anderson. As you said, I'm from the University of Pittsburgh, where I'm a general internist and a health services researcher. And I do still have Twitter, though shrinking attention to it, I guess. I think my handle's Tim Anderson, MD.
Outstanding. So tonight we're talking about the manuscript that we discussed in FJC, Clinical Outcomes of Intensive Inpatient Blood Pressure Management in Hospitalized Older Adults. And Tim is the lead author. How did you wrestle this project together? What's the story there?
You know, it's the well-worn story of being a confused med student, wondering why we give people IV blood pressure medicines, and then 10 years later trying to do your best to answer that question. But I think it's been a series of studies that we've done trying to say, can we provide any sort of context to the very, very common decisions that we make in the inpatient side of treating blood pressure?
Is this your most important paper that's ever been published? Is this, up to now, the pinnacle? Or is this, oh no, you should have seen what I published last year?
I don't know. In this space, we've done a couple hypertension papers that I think have been somewhat useful over the years. The main prequel to this was a very similar question, but trying to ask what happens when you send people home on new blood pressure meds. And that one, I think, has hopefully tried to influence a little bit of practice as people think about.
Why don't you just quickly run that? What was that study?
So that was also a JAMA Internal Medicine study. I think it came out in 2018 or 19 with an almost identical title, except it's something like clinical outcomes of discharging patients with new or intensified antihypertensive meds after hospitalization. And basically the question was, if you're in the hospital for something that has nothing to do with blood pressure, like pneumonia, and we send you out on new blood pressure meds, how does that go? Does that actually lead to the things that we'd hope, like reduced cardiovascular events, or does that lead to things we might not hope for, like readmissions for adverse events and falls?
So you were, so in this case, you were looking at the outcomes after discharge?
Right.
If patients had intensification of blood pressure medications while they were in the hospital. That was exactly. Your two groups, people that did or did not.
If they were sent home with them, yeah, exactly.
If they were sent home with more, so one group was people that were sent home with intensification of blood pressure medication, and then the other group was sent home without intensification of blood pressure medications. Is that fair? Don't leave us on the edge of our seat. What did you guys find?
We did not find improvements in cardiovascular outcomes at a year. We did find increased adverse events at a month. The other thing we saw in some kind of SQL papers is partly, presumably, some of the explanation of this is half of these folks don't stick on these meds for more than a couple months. So presumably, you don't really have that risk factor reduction if you're not taking the medicine long enough to have that risk factor reduction.
So these medicines get started and they don't get continued.
You got it.
It's a non-adherence saves them. Otherwise, things would be worse.
Now, my hypertension. But, you know, friends, this is, you so, guys just got back from a hypertension meeting, right? Where were you at?
Yeah. So that's what I was going to say. This was we had the AHA hypertension meeting. Jordi and I were there in Boston like a couple of weeks ago. Our work, you know, Jordi and I probably are the anti Tim in some ways. Is that we are saying let's lower blood pressure. It leads to better outcomes, and everything Tim has done is saying, oh, you know, you start BP medications. I'm just half joking. There is a much better nuanced take on this, but it's kind of showing that maybe it's not always the right thing to do. It all depends on the setting.
Okay. Jordi, why don't you light the light and tell us about this? Tell us about what we're talking about. Give us some background.
Yeah. So we've all been that person on the receiving end of when I was in training the page. Nowadays, I think it's text messages and phone calls on your cell phone of a well-meaning nurse calling you upset about a patient whose blood pressure is running 170 over 90, 180 over 100, 190 over 100. I can give any number off the top of my head. We've gotten hundreds of those calls during training, after training, regardless of what any of us trained in. And us, in return, don't want to disappoint this well-meaning nurse who just wants to prevent this patient from having a bad outcome from their high blood pressure. And we get guilted into responding by ordering an as-needed antihypertensive medication. Early in training, we often get told by a senior, oh, just order an IV medication that'll work fastest, like IV hydralazine. And you can hear my voice crack as I mentioned that. And then as we get more experience and see the patients who get very abruptly hypotensive after receiving IV hydralazine, maybe we get a little bit wiser and order oral short-acting medications as needed. Then as people get more experienced and a little bit wiser, maybe they order a longer acting antihypertensive medication as needed, like amlodipine. All of these things are done out of guilt, and all of these things are done out of a lack of data to support doing them. We've got amazing data supporting, as Swapnil was alluding to, supporting intensive blood pressure control in outpatients. However, this is based off of some very, very important caveats that in the outpatient setting, we can do a very standardized blood pressure where people are sitting, not lying in Trendelenburg position for 3 to 5 minutes with their arm at the level of their heart and do it on a bare arm, following all of these strict rules that we follow to get a standardized reading, get the average of 3 readings, which very rarely occurs in the inpatient setting. We then know that that relates to long-term cardiovascular outcomes. In this situation, there are rarely major confounders, like the anxiety of not knowing what's about to happen in my inpatient hospitalization that I'm here for surgery or whatever other reason, the pain I'm dealing with postoperatively or for whatever other reason that I'm in the hospital, and so many other stress-related factors that could be involved besides just the measurement error. So there's a lot of very, very stark and important differences between the inpatient setting of blood pressure measurement and assessment and the outpatient setting of blood pressure measurement and assessment. And unsurprisingly, because the hospital is such a stressful place to be in where you would expect there to be an regulation of our sympathetic nervous system, we end up seeing very, very high rates of inpatient hypertension, even among people who don't have a diagnosis of hypertension. There have been prior studies that have shown rates as high as 50 to 70% of people have inpatient hypertension. Tim did a great study in the past that showed that a lot of these people get treated for their inpatient hypertension, potentially inappropriately, as we'll talk about as we continue with the discussion today. I think that really the key take home is there have been several smaller studies done, including the ones that Tim had described. Those weren't small, but some other single center studies or single health system studies that have shown or suggested that there could be harm from potentially treating people for inpatient elevated blood pressures when they're in isolation, when someone's not presenting, of course, with malignant hypertension, with signs of target organ damage from their hypertension. This is strictly benign elevations in blood pressure, or what we should think of as benign elevations in blood pressure. What I think a lot of people think of as hypertensive urgency often, they're showing up in the ER with this, where you don't see any acute kidney injury, you don't see somebody in flash pulmonary edema, you don't see somebody with an aortic dissection, just isolated elevated blood pressures. And so Tim Anderson and his group embarked upon a series of exciting studies that he just described, and this was really the pinnacle of that, looking at what happens when patients are treated acutely for those elevated blood pressures while inpatient.
But the study, the way, in fact, this is the first sentence of the introduction, I was just rereading it, is that we don't measure blood pressure because we want to treat that hypertension. The blood pressure is measured as a vital sign, right? And it's mostly we are looking for hypotension because we are worried of somebody's blood pressure being low or falling when they are coming in with sepsis or trauma or what have you, right? That's why the blood pressure is checked in the emergency. It's mostly we are worried about low blood pressure, but it's a vital sign. And the nurse is calling you because they are worried about the number.
Well,
it's a high number. How can you ignore that high number?
When we were a resident, we used to talk about, oh, that blood pressure's so high, that patient's going to stroke out. Is that a thing, or did we just make that disease up?
Yes.
We made that up.
We made that disease up.
I mean, intracranial hemorrhages and intracranial hemorrhages happen and as a result of hypertension, but typically that person's presenting
right, I just want to make
symptoms.
Sure I get this understood. The idea was you get autoregulation of the cerebral vasculature, and if your blood pressure is that high, it's got to squeeze so tightly to prevent the blood pressure from being transmitted. There was no blood being transmitted to the brain, and that was the cause of the stroke. Was that a fiction that we created? I'm looking at your faces and your guys. What are you talking about, Dr. Toff?
Go ahead.
Yeah. So, but the whole thing about treating the number is what drives this, right? How can you ignore this objective sign? Going back to the AHA conference that we were at a couple of weeks ago, there were a bunch of presentations from hypertensionologists saying, you know, we are bad. We ignore all these BPs from the EMR. So Harlan Krumholz from Yale, he had a presentation where, oh, you know, the blood pressure in the EMR, 180 over 120 or so, like so many times, and nothing is done. So it's from the other end, right? Saying that, oh, we are ignoring this. At the same time, not having any context about how was this blood pressure taken, as Jordi pointed out, what was the context, right? Maybe they are in pain. It was a poorly done blood pressure. But the concern is that we are ignoring this easily reported outcome, which is in the EMR. That's why we treat it. That's why the resident who is called is saying, okay, you know, I'll not be negligent. I will give something. I have this weapon which can lower that number. Let's use it.
And I mean, we're nephrology, at least at our university, nephrology is sort of the hypertension group. We get called so often for this. Can you help us with our patient's labile hypertension while inpatient?
And you tell them.
And so then, like, what can you do? Now we're really pushing it with this great, better quality data that's been coming out to really tell people, hey, we're causing, this is a problem. We shouldn't act on it. But for years, people were giving recommendations on ways to help manage labile hypertension while inpatient.
Hey, C, what do they do in pediatrics world? Do they measure blood pressures on little kids?
In pediatrics, they measure blood pressures on little kids, and they are actually much more aggressive about treating hypertension in the inpatient setting in kids.
Because of all the outcome data they have showing better outcomes, fewer strokes, pediatric strokes.
you know, peds is just a wealth of data on outcomes. I think the theory is, you know, so in kids, it's so much harder to get a reliable blood pressure reading. So there's so many fewer times where we even think it's reliable or kind of think about it at all. I will say that because they're crying, they're upset, they're really stressed out by being in the hospital. But if we think that it's a reliable reading, like if, for example, they're hypertensive while they're asleep or while they're calm, they tend to be a lot more aggressive in treating it because of the concerns for press in kids and the overall thought that those kids probably don't have hypertension in the outpatient setting. Although after this, I'm not sure we should really be thinking in adults that they have, you know, to your point that inpatient hypertension and outpatient hypertension are necessarily, you know, the same subset of patients, Jordy, or that they're, you know, there may be significantly more adults with inpatient hypertension than outpatient hypertension. But I think in kids, if we think we can get a reliable reading, they're much more likely to treat it. I would also just like to say, as a side note, that Jordy is really underselling how much Penn is the hypertension division, because when I was there, at least they pushed to have renal and hype division on their badges as a shorthand for hypertension, which I think that all of us should still have. I don't know if you still have that, but I distinctly remember that from being a medical student, that you guys were the renal and hype division. And I think we should all aspire to be that.
AC, do you get these calls?
Oh, yeah. All
you
the
get
time,
the calls from the nurses with hypertension?
We get calls for hypertension all the time, on the pediatric and on the adult side. And a lot of it sometimes too is like you're saying, people are uncomfortable with these numbers and people are well-meaning, but we'll even get calls like they're hypertensive and they broke their arm and they, you know, just had to have this fixed. And it's like, well, I would be quite hypertensive if I had a broken bone that I were dealing with or things like that. But it makes people incredibly uncomfortable. They just don't know what to do, or they don't know the data. So all the time we still get these calls.
Tim, what have we missed in this kind of framing of this article?
I think that's a fair framing. You know, the other thing that always comes to mind when I frame these is how we think about pulse in the hospital. So, right, like if we're calling hypertension a vital sign and we call pulse a vital sign, so it's always been a weird disconnect to me that we don't really chase around people whose like heart rate hits 102 and say like, we need to beta blockade these people. Like, we cannot have heart rates of 102. That's insane. And we just kind of, you know, have normalized this idea that, like, you know, when people are uncomfortable, like, their heart rate goes up. When people are scared, their heart rate goes up. And I always, at least when I teach or talk to like trainees and residents, try to like reset some of that, you know, like blood pressure is a vital sign and it's a chronic disease. And those are very different kind of settings and pieces. And I don't know, for some reason, the pulse piece, I think, works for me also in terms of like a way to maybe reframe just our approach a little bit. That being said, nurses still like to call doctors about high pulses. So some of the alarm fatigue is still there.
I got a question. So if you were just to look, map out blood pressures versus hospital outcomes, do you get a J curve like we see with outpatients where they have bad outcomes with very low blood pressures and good outcomes with middle and bad outcomes with high blood pressure? Same thing happened in the inpatient, or there's no relationship? Is it a scatterplot? No, I'm talking about no interventions. Just look at their blood pressure and look at their outcomes. Just curious.
I mean, you'd have to kind of take away all the people whose blood pressure was like 40, right? Because of their sepsis and their, you know, exsanguinated GI bleed and all those things. So I imagine like hypertension is extra bad in the hospital.
Yeah, I imagine.
I don't know. That's a good question. I don't know the answer to the idea of kind of like if you took the average person whose blood pressure was 130 versus 150 in the hospital, to the point Jordy made before, that the measurement is so poor. That's like the other challenge is, I think variability in measurement is way higher in the hospital than it is in the outpatient setting.
To AC's point also, I think there's a lot of potential for confounding here. That broken arm in the adult world is more likely to be somebody who came in and had a major surgery, or somebody who had some other anxiety or pain-inducing event that would make them potentially have a much higher blood pressure, but also have a potentially higher risk otherwise of adverse outcomes. So I think it's very hard to tease that out.
Yeah, and to Joel's point about, you know, the hospital blood pressure, it's like, which blood pressure will you take? You know, the admitting blood pressure, the discharge blood pressure, the highest blood pressure during the admission, the lowest blood pressure during the admission. There are so many numbers, which is, you know, again, I was looking at the methods and it was, this was a difficult study to pull off. So we'll get into that. I'm kind of trying to nudge you into, hey, can we get into the methods, please?
Why don't we get into the methods? Let's do it. Let's do it.
So this is an observational study, a retrospective cohort study done using inpatient as well as outpatient clinical and pharmacy data from the Veterans Affairs. So they linked a bunch of databases. And this is important because they are not trying to take people in whom they don't have any outpatient information. These are specific cohort of patients where they do have previous outpatient information. Because if a patient is on amlodipine during admission, do you know if they were on amlodipine before or was it started new, right? That's the key, one of the key aspects here. So in this case, they needed to have patients in whom they knew what they were taking before. So that's why I guess the choice of the Veterans Affairs, because you get a large number of patients and you get all this wealth of data about them in the previous setting. So obviously this was, 65 years of older who were admitted at a veterans.
Tim, why did you just look at these older people? Why not take all comers?
So mainly in some ways, the same way a trial might enrich, people at higher risk of both cardiovascular events and adverse events. I think older adults, right, are the ones who face both of those risks. People. And then, it was also funded by NIA, who I think appropriately were interested in kind of the harms to older adults, specifically kind of framed perhaps differently than.
I'm sorry, was that three-letter acronym funded by who?
The National Institute on Aging.
Oh, that
so
makes
as
sense.
Opposed, right, to being funded by one of the kidney or heart groups that the aging institutes love to focus on risk benefit balance.
Gotcha. Okay.
For
so
just
you,
those
so
folks.
You're enriching for increased outcomes, and the people with the wallet were like, "Look at us."
Though I do want to jump in, I think there is a lot higher inertia in older patients. There was just an article that came out from Adam Bress's group about this. In SPRINT, older patients were less likely to have their medications escalated, even though they were supposed to by protocol. And so I think in general, older patients may be less likely to have these medications escalated, and that if we were to repeat this in a younger population, that we could even see more escalation of medications and maybe more events. But per Tim's point, they might not be as high risk to develop the events.
Okay. Exactly right. So this is sort of like in terms of methodology. And again, I'm hoping Tim and Jordi will jump in more and more as we get deeper into the study, because these are complex methodologies. But this is sort of like emulating a trial. Let's think about the patient population. So these are, veterans over 65 years of age, admitted to a veterans hospital, and they need to have data, right? So these are patients who had to have data from veterans pharmacy, because there are some patients who, go to non-veterans pharmacy. So in that case, you wouldn't have enough data on them. You exclude them. So you need to have that kind of data. That is one of the inclusion criteria. But then you're also looking at, after they are hospitalized, maybe there are some patients who should be treated for hypertension, right? So those kind of patients are being excluded, because you are sort of trying to say, hey, what kind of patient population could you randomize to getting a blood pressure pill versus not getting a pill? So they excluded patients with certain diagnoses like, cardiac conditions, cerebrovascular conditions, vascular and renal failure. So people with those admitting diagnoses in whom there might be specific blood pressure targets, I presume, those were excluded.
And some evidence guiding the use of blood pressure medications in those populations.
Especially like if you come in with an MI, you're going to get a beta blocker or, an ACE inhibitor or what have you, right? It's not going to be for hypertension reasons and so on.
Yeah, and it's not, and you're getting rid of all the potential hypertensive emergencies, right? The people who you really absolutely do need to lower blood pressure and their guidelines and exactly.
So we are trying to get that patient population that Jordi mentioned earlier, those who have the asymptomatic high blood pressure, right? So that's the kind of population we are aiming to get. They're also excluding, dialysis patients whose blood pressure is often managed by dialysis, and mostly those who were not being followed in the veterans pharmacy and so on.
Tim, there's no consort diagram. What happened to that?
There is.
Where?
It's in the supplement. It's in the supplement.
Wait a minute.
I think AC was right. Joel claims he read the supplement. He just has the supplement.
It's E-figure 1.
Never mind.
Tim, was that in your original manuscript? Like, when did that get pushed into the supplement, the consort diagram?
Oh, I think it was in there. We certainly added some things by the journal request, hence why there's like 10 tables that kind of look the same, but are all a slightly different subgroup, but so goes. The only thing I'll add to swap your kind of summary pieces, we were probably, if anything, let's say overly conservative in what we called a reason to be in the hospital that could be related to blood pressure. So the example would be, we had to focus on people's admitting concerns, because if you focus on their discharging concerns, like if they had a heart attack later on in the hospital stay, they get excluded out, which doesn't work.
Right. And that's an outcome for you guys.
And so we excluded, for example, people who were just coming in with chest pain. And clearly a bunch of that chest pain doesn't end up being cardiac. But presumably, if you're actually admitting somebody with chest pain, blood pressure management in that setting is probably, focused on the concern of it being a hypertensive emergency, even if that doesn't end up quite being the case. So it really is a people coming in for things that have nothing to do conceptually with blood pressure.
Exactly. The other part of the inclusion is then, how is the cohort formed? So the cohort is patients, again, this is sort of like an inclusion criteria in a trial, right? So these are patients who have to have hypertension. So in this case, hypertension is defined as two blood pressure measurements, which are 140 over 90 or higher in the first 48 hours. So that's sort of the patient population. And the intervention is a receipt of either a new oral antihypertensive medication or any IV antihypertensive medication.
Even if they're on IV antihypertensives as an outpatient.
Presumably, people have not done IV.
I have a number of ambulatory phenoldepam patients that I'm taking care of.
So except for practices like Joel, luckily we didn't have anyone from Joel's practice. But you know, so that was sort of the intervention, is to looking at new antihypertensive medications. And again, it makes sense, is that patient's blood pressure is over 140-90, and they got a new pill, so it was probably a reaction to that number, right? So there we are trying to capture the patients where asymptomatic high numbers are driving a management, an intervention.
And so I want to jump in here. So I used the term earlier, hypertensive urgency, which to me is a dirty word. I hate that term because it really doesn't actually get at what's happening here. But I think it gets at the reason that people jump on these numbers. What do you guys think of this in terms of like 140 over 90 as the cutoff? Tim, maybe can you comment on why you chose 140 over 90?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, I think, you know, you could say like, let's only focus on 160s and 170s and 180s. And at some point you run out of people to actually have enough power to do much with. But also when we've looked in the past at kind of what anchors, for example, like standing orders, a lot of times there'll be standing orders where somebody puts in an order for nursing that just says like, give medicines if blood pressure hits 160 or something like that. And we wanted to at least have a low enough threshold that we weren't only picking off kind of standing orders, that there was presumably some amount of clinical decision making into it. I feel like at some point we might have done a 150 cutoff just to like convince ourselves that it didn't really matter that we did 140 and saw the same thing. But I forget if the reviewers made us put that into the supplement somewhere.
But that was something that you guys did as part of this process. You're like, well, let's rerun these numbers, but use 150 rather than 140. Is that something you did, or you're not sure you did that?
Yeah, we certainly didn't go lower. Like, we didn't try to do 130s or stuff, because I think that's just starting to get too wacky for the hospital. But I think we did at least try once or twice higher cutoffs. And I know we did a stratified look at folks whose blood pressure was particularly high when they came in, and we can talk about that later.
Okay. And all calcium channel blockers are the same if they had diltiazem added because they had AFib with RVR and they were on amlodipine. That's no additional blood pressure medicine, because that's calcium channel blocker to calcium channel blocker. I just want to make sure I understand that. That's how it worked.
Yeah. So we kept everything as if you were on that class. The fact that you're like on another med in the same class doesn't count as a new med. Because there's often, especially in the VA with formularies, somebody might come in on enalapril and they only carry lisinopril sort of things. And those substitutions are so common.
So again, it's a pretty conservative approach. We are only getting new classes of drugs being added. So that's pretty decent.
But I just want to say, if the person came in and they were on 30 of nifedipine or 2.5 of amlodipine, and then the doctor said, no, it's going to be 90 of nifedipine, you wouldn't catch that as an intensification of blood pressure medication, even though they went from placebo amlodipine to knock them out nifedipine.
Absolutely true. We left those off the table mainly because it gets a little dicey in sometimes with the outpatient pharmacy data in determining what someone's exact dose is, because sometimes they're written for take the half tab or take two of these. And the VA is actually better than most places at being able to track that. But we're trying to go conservative. For bumping somebody's lisinopril 25% is not enough.
And I'm going to jump in because as much as I love the whole idea of adding any new drug being part of this, when you're mentioning drugs like amlodipine, this is a drug that it takes 5 days to reach. It's like at least to reach its full effect, even when you escalate the dose. Often it takes a week to 2 weeks. And so I think that these little dose changes or within like long acting class changes really are not too consequential when it comes to short term outcomes.
Exactly right. Yeah. And the other thing with that discussion also is that for all you know, so these kind of, I think, decisions, if at all, would bias the study toward the null perhaps. And not really cause us bias in the direction that we found it would be. For all you know, some patients may not be adherent, and when they get put on what they are supposed to be taking anyway, that also might be happening here. That was the patient population and the intervention. The outcomes are, they excluded any outcomes happening in the first 48 hours because, you know, it's too early for the intervention to have an effect. Who knows what was going on there? So the outcomes are after the initial 48 hours of admission hospitalization. So people who, you know, died or had some event or got discharged in the first 48 hours, that doesn't get counted. So the primary outcome here was a composite of a bunch of things. So inpatient mortality, AKI, stroke, myocardial injury, BNP elevation, and ICU transfer. It's an interesting mix. You know, if once I read this, it sort of makes sense. You know, what made you choose those particular things, including BNP elevation?
Yeah. So, I mean, we were looking at, I guess, signs of myocardial strain as they could be defined in different ways, right, with troponins or BNP. The ICU piece is a little bit of the idea that anytime something kind of goes off the rails in the VA, people get sent to the ICU. Like, it's a much lower threshold to the ICU than I think the average hospital, or at least average tertiary hospital, is. And our ability to track blood pressures once people are in the ICU is actually a little bit variable. So part of the reason for that is also in some ways like self-serving for if you've gotten to the ICU. We know things are getting worse without always being able to track what your blood pressures are.
I just want to make sure I understand. Because ICU is an outcome, anybody admitted to the ICU was automatically, on admission, was excluded from your study because that would have been an outcome within the first 48 hours, as Swap said.
You got it.
And I'm just going to jump in here and dig a little deeper in what Tim was describing. As somebody who did my internal medicine residency at least several months in the ICU at the Boston VA, where Tim probably was heavily inspired, the all of the nursing ICU vitals were done on paper. So this was well into when CPRS had existed for like, what, decades now. This was in the 20-teens, when literally still every ICU blood pressure was by hand. So I don't know how long that went on for, but I think it probably was still the case for a few years after I left.
It might still be the case at some VAs, but so it goes. Not all.
That's crazy. When you said, you know, blood pressure's ICU may be difficult, I didn't understand that, but I guess that's it does make sense now if they're doing it by paper.
Oh, and many of the nurses would trace the directionality of it. So you'd get this beautiful graph of how the blood pressure had been doing over the 24 hours.
Nice.
But nothing in the EMR. So apart from these, the composite outcome, there were secondary outcomes, which were each of these, you know, like hospitalization, ICU, AKI.
All the individual components of your composite.
All the individual components, but they also had hypotensive episode. You know, again, you're lowering blood pressure. So blood pressure less than... systolic less than 100 was a secondary outcome.
So,
length of stay. Yeah.
But that's not part of the composite. The hypotension is just part of an individual.
Hypotension.
Hypotension
exactly.
is just
it's an individual secondary.
But it's not part of the composite outcome.
It's not. Yeah, okay. It's not part of the composite outcome. Also, length of stay and discharge disposition. And actually, on discharge disposition, so, you know, people going home or going to a skilled nursing facility. I should add that people coming from a skilled nursing facility were excluded. Yeah. So again, if they are going to a skilled nursing facility, they are coming from home and going to a skilled nursing facility, which is one of the outcomes for discharge disposition.
And Tim, is this a problem with being able to get their pharmacy records? Is that why you had to exclude people that were coming from nursing homes?
Yeah, that's absolutely the case for why we exclude those folks out. I'll say the reason that we were particularly interested in this idea of the outcome of folks going to nursing home actually kind of is reflected by this idea that often physical therapy in these groups won't work with patients whose blood pressure is both too low and too high. So they'll have like kind of protocols that we are not allowed to get people out of bed and do this sort of walking. And so one of the things that we initially thought about is kind of a potential harm that's probably overlooked around over-treating blood pressure is if you actually make people orthostatic enough that then no one will do anything with them, the odds that they end up being told they have to go to nursing homes as opposed to home might shift.
But that's also one of the reasons that we get forced to treat these blood pressures is because the OT walks will not take care of them because their blood pressure is 200, right? Same reason you can't get your teeth drilled because you're hypertensive when you go to the dentist.
Sounds like the next thing to study.
Yeah, a poorly done blood pressure at the dentist usually. Again, and there are nuances about each of these individual definitions that we need not go into, like how was the myocardial injury, which is on the basis of an elevated troponin and so on and so forth. AKI, because we are nephrologists here, was stage 2 or greater, not the 26 micromole or 0.3 milligram per deciliter AKI. Serum creatinine increase of greater than or equal to 0.5 milligram per deciliter or twice the baseline value. These were the outcomes. And now we come to the fun part, which is before I go into the analysis, there were some subgroups as Tim had alluded earlier. So There were five different subgroups that they looked for, which are pre-specified. Patients older than, so this is people more than 65. So specifically, they looked at people who are more than 75 and those who are, you know, 65 to 75. Those who, patients with frailty at baseline or not frailty at baseline. Those who had an elevated outpatient blood pressure of more than 140 over 90 or those who had, you know, less than 140 over 90. Those with cardiovascular disease. We talked about 140, but they also looked at those who were in the 140 to 179 versus more than 180. You know, so because some of us think, you know, 180 is worse than 145. So these were the subgroups. And now I come to the analysis part. You know, you had a group of patients who, these were all patients who had a blood pressure of more than 140 over 90. Some of them got pills and some of them did not get these pills. Pills are IV medications. The issue here is that there is a lot of confounding, right? There's a selection bias even, right? Like we, as clinicians, I know something about the patient, which is why I choose to give this patient, add hydralazine to this patient and not add hydralazine to that patient. That, how do you tease that out? Is it just, you know, the intern who gets called at night who is giving this randomly, or is there something else that's going on?
How do you differentiate that? Is the patient who gets treated doing worse because they had worse disease or because they got treated? This is the problem exactly with this whole field of study, right?
Exactly. So there are many different ways of doing that. So one way of doing this analysis is to do a logistic regression at the end from that end of the analysis, looking at a certain number of covariates. The other approach often is to do a propensity score matching, where you try to look at all the baselines and, you know, weed out and pick only patients who are sort of similar. And you throw out a lot of data while you're doing that. In this case, they are doing a target trial emulation. So they used a method called the overlap weighting approach. I'd like Tim to enlighten us a little bit more on what exactly they did.
Sure. So
just like broad strokes.
So overlap weighting is kind of a another way to think about propensity scores. So if propensity scores are really saying what's the likelihood that an individual is going to be treated with more intensive blood pressure, if you propensity score match, just like you said, you throw out a lot of people, but you also are kind of matching, if you can, the people with very, very high propensity, like everyone's going to treat them, and the people whose propensity is almost no, but like somebody forgot to treat them because they didn't answer their pager or something like that. What overlap weighting does is it tries to essentially weight up people for whom there's the most clinical equipoise. So those people whose propensity to be treated is in the middle. And that kind of downweights wonky outliers. So in some ways, it's like the opposite of inverse probability weighting in some ways. That's also a popular approach to this. And so it's meant to get you closer to kind of the ideals behind a clinical trial, and that you're really trying to focus your analytic effort on the patients who seem to have clinical equipoise, at least so much as you can judge that by what you were able to measure.
So if you look at, you know, the table one in the paper has like, you know, five or six covariates. But if you look at the E table, it has got like, I don't know, 100 covariates that you were putting in. That looks like a lot of work. I guess all these covariates were used to make your overlap weighting approach. And the difference in those numbers, you know, I don't want to steal AC's thunder, but it's kind of very interesting to see the unadjusted and the table one after overlap weighting was done.
AC, you're going to be talking about E table two or E table one, E table two, is what it is, right? Make sure I want you to go deep in E table two when you get there. Okay? I downloaded this supplement and I want to get my money's worth.
So this is one approach, right? There are different approaches to doing this. Is there a particular reason you thought this approach would be better than others or more convenient than others?
In terms of the overlap weighting specifically?
Yeah.
So, yeah. You know, I think the primary reason we wanted to focus on it was this concern that there are a lot of outliers in both directions. And so, you know, one example being somebody whose blood pressure is 141, who has no cardiovascular disease, who's like 95. Presumably, most people aren't going to treat that person. I mean, maybe, maybe not. And then the person whose blood pressure is 195, who's 65 and had a heart attack like 6 months ago. Most people are probably going to like lean towards that. And so we really wanted to try to get at the focus on what you might do if you were trying to build a clinical trial to answer this question, which is presumably you would enroll people who there's truly clinical equipoise behind. I mean, you probably wouldn't be enrolling really, really, really low risk people, but you also may not be enrolling the highest of the high risk.
Fantastic. Anything else you would add, Jordi, to the methods that I didn't cover?
Yeah, just, Tim mentioned inverse probability of treatment weighting, and that's another really common approach for target trial emulation, where you're doing your best in a scenario where there's never likely going to be a randomized control trial to try to emulate one, to make it as close to one as possible. And I think Tim already elaborated on this, but the inverse probability of treatment weighting literally just takes the inverse of a propensity score, essentially. There's more to it than that, but the result of that is it creates a pseudopopulation where the people who are the least likely to receive your treatment end up getting inflated, and they count a lot bigger in your to essentially weight the population to make sure that there is equipoise across both groups. And so just to elaborate on why it's so important not to do that approach in this scenario, that 95-year-old that had the 141 systolic blood pressure would have counted for 1,000 or maybe 10,000 people in a study like this if you used inverse probability of treatment weighting. So there are many scenarios where inverse probability of treatment weighting is an outstanding option to address outliers that need to be more represented because they're not adequately represented in the study and they are going to happen in reality. This is definitely a scenario where you don't want that 95-year-old to count for 10,000 people.
Exactly right. And in terms of methods, you know, I'm looking at other studies which I've looked at, you know, inpatient stuff. And I'm not saying this because Tim is on the podcast, but this is, you know, as good as it can be, right? Short of doing a trial, this is a pretty robust study design. I can't find, I'm sure you can find some weaknesses. This doesn't include every single thing, but it's pretty good as things go.
I think I'm just as angry of a reviewer as Swapnil, and I agree with you.
Okay. Swap, are you done with methods?
I am finally done with the methods. It's only
Tim, what did we miss? What part of the methods you're like, oh, this is super important. I can't believe Swap missed it.
So the only thing I'll push on is that what we thought was the hardest thing to set up, and thus I don't know that we're proud of it or not, but like at least we think that it was the only way we could envision approaching it is really like how do you envision that an actual trial would go in order to try to emulate this, right? So maybe the actual trial would be that you would tell the nurses and the hospitalists and everybody in the hospital, like, floor number one, the target blood pressure is 140. Floor number two, the target blood pressure is 180 or something like that. Like something that kind of tries to get at like a sprint type outpatient trial target. But that's actually really hard to envision in the real world. And it's entirely impossible to do in observational data. So our whole focus on really using those first 48 hours to kind of define how you get treated was this idea that docs who are going to treat somebody for their asymptomatic high blood pressure in the first 48 hours are probably going to keep treating them. And then docs who are not are probably not going to keep treating them. And that's not perfect because, you know, services shift and all of those different sorts of things. But the real premise of kind of that exposure is this idea that we can infer kind of treatment patterns based on those first 48 hours to look forward. And some of the challenges with prior studies that have tried to look at this is they've sometimes taken approaches that don't always clinically make sense. So like, we want to know what happens if we treat the highest blood pressure a patient has during their whole hospital stay, which would be great, except as a doctor, right, we don't know that the blood pressure we see in front of us is the highest blood pressure they're going to have. Like, we don't know the future. We can't tell what's going to happen the next day. And so I think we spent a lot of time trying to figure, like, how do we most think about this as a trial in a research question that you really can't quite emulate a trial perfectly for.
Okay. I just want for the people following at home that was quite a bit of that he was really commenting on it. Was it Rastogi? That used that exact trial design?
Yeah, the Cleveland Clinic study. Yeah, and they looked at it.
Who's the lead author on that? Did I get that right? Is it Rastogi?
Yeah, it was Radhika Rastogi and Michael Rothberg was the senior. Yeah.
Yeah, Rothberg.
And they used the peak blood pressure during the hospitalization as one of their key criteria. Is that right? But their conclusions were similar to yours. There was no advantage to and a significant signal for harm, right, to treating hypertension. But it's a different trial design. Okay.
Well, don't get to the conclusions yet.
You haven't
AC. AC, hit us with the methods before I spill the conclusions.
The results. Hit us with the results.
Okay, so anybody feel free to jump in, but we'll get going here on the results. So, you know, after we kind of go through these, you know, inclusion exclusion criteria that we already talked about, they ended up including 66,140 patients, actually quite a number. And then as we talked about, all of them had to have multiple elevated blood pressures in the first 48 hours. And that's, again, greater than or equal to 140 over 90. The mean age of the patients was 74.4 years. So again, certainly looking at an elderly population, which we talked about, keeping in mind that this is a VA population, 97.5% of them were men or were male, and then 75.9% were white. So just keeping those kind of demographic data in mind. Of these patients, 21.3%, so a little over a fifth of them, received intensive blood pressure treatment in the first 48 hours. And again, that's defined as an IV antihypertensive, any IV antihypertensive, even if you're Joel's patient who's on them as an outpatient, or a new class of blood pressure medicine. And so of those group that received intensive blood pressure treatment in the first 48 hours, 17.8%, so almost 18%, received IV antihypertensives. Those who received the intensive treatment.
It's 20% got treated, and then 20% of the treated got treated with IV.
Yeah.
A little close enough.
Close enough.
One in five. Okay, interesting.
And so those who had the treatment had similar demographics overall to those who didn't. They did have higher systolic blood pressures prior to admission, so the mean was 140 versus 135. And they were more likely to have a reading of greater than 180 in the first 48 hours.
And I want to emphasize, the demographics were balanced after the weighting that was done, after you guys did the statistical manipulation, right? You're looking at the results after much statistical hocus pocus. And then they were looking very similar.
Not hocus pocus. It's a sophisticated, yeah.
Here's the deal. I don't understand it, so it's hocus pocus, right? There's much statistical manipulation that's way beyond my high school algebra.
I'm going to argue on that, though, because if you start calling it statistical wizardry and like hocus pocus and whatnot and all those terms, it basically gets at, I don't trust these results. And I think that there's something that we really need to do where we elevate these more rigorously done analyses to point out that these are trustworthy because they're done right. I appreciate the humor of it, but I think that it's one of these like situations where people can maybe then overinterpret it the wrong way.
Exactly. And the other thing is that the table one is or the e-table two is fun to look at because it tells you the importance of doing this, right? Like the patients are different. The unadjusted analysis, there are many covariates which are quite different. So you really can't analyze it like that, right? You need to do what Tim and his team had to do, because otherwise you would end up with a very confounded result.
What is this VISN percent? V-I-S-N percent?
VISNs are regions of the VA. So the same way that in another study, gotcha, you might, you know, control for states or something like that.
To some extent,
the idea being that maybe everybody in the same region got trained by the same people and practiced similarly. And thus, we should control for the fact that, you know, Boston is different than Chicago or something like that.
It's uncanny how similar the two groups are after the overlap weighting. Like, it's amazing.
It's really impressive.
So it's inevitable, I guess, with overlap weighting and kind of the design of it, because it functionally kind of, it results in the idea that everything is balanced on the mean.
Everything is balanced. It is. I mean, every line. And Swap wasn't kidding. Like there's over 100 lines in this table, and everything's exactly balanced.
But what it hides a little bit is that the variation around that mean can differ. So unsurprisingly, the larger population will have a wider variation of ranges that make up that, you know, mean blood pressure 140. They're going to have a wider group that goes into that. And so as much as it looks perfect, it still obscures a little bit of the fact that while things are balanced on the mean, there can still be quite a bit of different spread in one population versus the other, so long as that the means match up. And the people who don't like propensity scores, that's often their like big push against that.
Okay.
So for those who received early intensive treatment, so again, within those kind of first 48 hours, they continued to receive a greater number of additional antihypertensives throughout their hospitalization. So 6 doses versus 1.6. This was also, you know, one of the things that I like that you guys did was this was also a higher number of mean doses per day, right? So it's not just, oh, they received additional numbers, during their hospitalization, but also they were hospitalized longer. So in terms of mean doses per day, they tended to receive 0.9, so basically an additional dose per day compared to 0.3. So again, additional doses and not just because of the length of hospitalization. And then if you received an IV antihypertensive, you were more likely to receive additional IV antihypertensives during the remainder of your hospitalization. So that was 1.4 versus 0.1. So really those who kind of received IV antihypertensives during this first 48 hours tended to continue to receive them, and those who didn't really didn't get them afterwards. In the intensively treated group, after the first 48-hour period now, so we're kind of looking at, you know, you started treating them or intensified them during the first 48 hours, and then what happened afterwards, the mean systolic blood pressures were a little bit lower, so 138 versus 139.4. I will just point out that the confidence intervals on those actually don't overlap, so they were lower, but clinically, that's pretty meaningless to me, the 138 versus 139.4. I don't really think much about that, which I think is relevant when we talk about kind of the negative outcomes versus the benefit that we're getting, even of just calming ourselves down internally, of making the number look better. It doesn't really do that. They had a 5.5 millimeter of mercury reduction in the mean systolic blood pressure versus 4.1 in the untreated group. So again, was it greater? Yes. Was it really clinically significant to me? No. In terms of the actual kind of other outcome that we're looking at, right? And the really big one is like, does this matter? Intensive treatment was associated with a greater risk of the primary composite outcome. And again, that primary composite outcome was inpatient mortality, ICU transfer, AKI, stroke, BNP elevation, and troponin elevation. So in terms of that primary composite outcome, the intensive treatment group, the rate was 8.7% versus 6.9% in the non-intensive group. And the weighted odds ratio was 1.28 with a confidence interval of 1.18 to 1.39. And then the number needed to harm was 56, but the range was anywhere from 37 to 75. Then they actually looked at the individual components of that composite outcome. And so except for stroke, which was very infrequent occurrence. So it was only 0.2% of the intensively treated group and 0.1% of the non-intensively treated group. And the mortality, which was not significant, it was 1.1% in both groups. So other than those two outcomes, the intensive treatment was more likely to experience each component of the composite outcome. So more likely
to everything experience. But death and stroke.
Yes.
I'm looking at the forest plot. This is figure two that we're looking at. Is that right? Mm-hmm. Looks like hypotension also crosses the, but that's not part of the composite, right?
That's not part of the primary composite outcome. Yep. And so then intensively treated patients were more likely to experience a hypotensive episode. So again, that's a systolic pressure less than 100. So that was 14.8% versus 14%. And they were less likely to be discharged to home. I just, you know, just kind of looking at each individual composite outcome, because I actually like that you guys kind of broke this down. And for me, you know, as a future nephrologist or as a nephrology fellow, I think this is relevant. I think AKI to me is actually even the most convincing one, right? Where like it's kind of got the tightest confidence interval. And we really see pretty convincing evidence that this causes an increased risk of AKI, or at least I think so. But I think all of these are actually pretty important.
Yeah. I mean, I could... Sorry, if I can jump in. I'm not so sure about AKI. as a nephrologist.
You can fix that.
We can fix that. And for all we know, some of it is this hypercreatininemia, right? Hemodynamics. You put someone on an ACE inhibitor, their creatinine may go up. Is it good or is it bad? Who knows, right?
Yeah.
So that's, and again, I'm not saying it is all good. I'm sure this is a mix of good and bad. But AKI, I don't know. But the ICU transfer and the skilled nursing facility discharge, even the rest of them, they are all going in the wrong direction. So overall, this is pretty bad.
Yeah, they really are. So I mean, pretty much Swapnil, every single one.
I have to ask Swapnil, are you blaming that BNP elevation on the rise in creatinine then?
No, I'm not. But who knows? Right? Who knows what happens?
But I do want to, this was touched on a little bit in the conclusion, is we didn't protocolize measuring the creatinine. And it's possible that people that are big on PRN and intensification of blood pressure with treating every tiny blood pressure are much more fastidious about ordering daily creatinines, getting BNPs with every chest pain. In this case, if you don't measure for the BNP, you can't get that outcome, right? And if you're not measuring the creatinine, you can't get the AKI. So did you guys look at the correlation with the likelihood of being in the intensive group with more frequent measuring of these things that required to reach these outcomes? Was that something you guys looked at?
That's a good question. I don't think we looked at it formally. I will say with creatinine, the missing data rates of, you know, not having multiple creatinines in the exposure period is pretty minuscule. And I think, I mean, by and large, that probably reflects the fact that it's still in this day and age hard to not get a creatinine drawn every day. I think that's a bigger risk and point with things like BMP. And I think part of the reason that we did some of the subgroups doing things like stratifying by known cardiovascular disease was out of that idea that presumably, you know, we're not checking BNPs on every single patient all the time, but we may well be checking them more frequently on people who are at that kind of pre-existing high risk.
Mm-hmm.
And just thinking kind of like, you know, how does the average hospitalist approach it?
And I want to argue, I think a lot of these IV drugs are more often ordered on surgical services and not in general medicine services. And I think this actually would bias towards
those surgeons.
I think that more often, not to belittle them, I think it's just more like that's what they're comfortable with. That's what we see anecdotally a lot more of. And I think that a lot of the hospitalists manage a lot more blood pressure and then have seen a lot more drops and get more scared by it and have more anecdotal experiences that shy them away from the IV drugs. I wonder if that could actually bias the result away from checking for BNP, because those might be patients that may be less likely to be on a service that's thinking a lot about that.
Yeah. And again, for the surgeons, they want the BP to be good, right? Otherwise, the anesthesiologist may say, no OR for you. That they may be much more focused on fixing the number in their culture.
Yeah. That's a good point.
I think that's the case. And I mean, I think of, at least, I don't know how it is elsewhere, but I know post-transplant is an example where like patients often, their discharge gets held up if their blood pressures aren't under control, which terrifies me. I know they're getting watched very, very closely. It's very different than people in the study often, but just thinking about like escalating the dose of amlodipine over and over and over again, just to get their blood pressure under control in the hospital and then discharge them knowing that they're about to diurese half their body weight. From this new functioning kidney.
They see where we're going.
Then they kind of looked at the breakdown of oral therapy only. So intensification, meaning adding just a new class of an oral medicine versus IV therapy. So they broke down this intensive group into those two different subgroups. And really there's a much bigger risk probably to be expected by anybody in this group when patients get IV therapy. You know, for example, the primary outcome, the odds ratio of the primary outcome with any IV treatment is 1.9 versus only 1.15 for the patients who received oral a new class of oral antihypertensives.
Tim.
So all of these risks, I agree, are pretty convincing to begin with, but then much more so when we look at the risk in the IV therapy group.
So we're talking about IV antihypertensives not in the ICU. Is it all hydralazine or is there still some labetalol in this mix? No, just what is it? What is the drug?
It is mostly hydralazine. There is some labetalol. I don't think we ended up with a table that showed all that, but it's...
I went through the supplement with a fine tooth comb. It's nothing.
You couldn't find it? All right. Then we definitely... a reviewer with your same mindset definitely asked us to at least send that to them and revise it, resubmit. But it is largely hydral and a little bit of labetalol and nothing else.
No enalapril at...
I mean, I think in some VAs, it's hard to even be allowed to give hydralazine on the floor. Some are pretty strict. So, certainly nothing more intensive.
Okay.
Those IV patients really had significantly increased risk of that primary outcome and then an increased odds of inpatient mortality. So their odds ratio for inpatient mortality was 1.79 compared to the oral antihypertensive group where the odds ratio of inpatient mortality was 0.96. And that did cross one for that confidence interval. So 0.76 to 1.21. And then an increased odds of ICU transfer in the patients who got IV antihypertensives. So 2.54 for that odds ratio versus 0.92. So again, you know, we do kind of convincingly see this increased risk across the board for a variety of outcomes in terms of patients who received intensification of blood pressure treatment, but really, really much more so in the patients who received IV therapy. So I think, I don't know that we needed another nail in the coffin for giving these patients IV antihypertensives, but certainly if we did, I think this is probably one of them.
The problem with the IV medications is presumably the rapid onset and the induction of hypotension. We see variability in onset, speed of onset with the oral drugs too. And did you break it down? Did you look at there are some like, so oral hydralazine, for example, rapid acting and short acting, and amlodipine, as Jordy says, you know, lowers the blood pressure. You need a bus to get there. Like, it takes forever for the blood pressure to go down. Did you guys look at onset of action for some of the oral agents and see if some of these other oral agents had a difference in outcomes?
We have not. There's been a couple single center studies. The most recent I can think of is one from Lama Ghazi, who was, I think, at Yale at the time, is now at UAB, who's looked at, you know, some of these questions around within the first 6 hours, how far do blood pressures drop, both, I think, with IV and perhaaps with oral as well. And I'd probably say that's the best set of evidence that we have, that and a couple of related studies on how fast and how variable some of those drops are, in part because of the fact that people could get different meds, you know, on hospital day 5 than they got on hospital day 1 in our study. We didn't try to focus a lot on those individual meds because there could be variation, and that just gets very, very messy to track, particularly with the one-offs. I think it's a little bit probably clearer if somebody was started on amlodipine and titrated up. But a lot of these folks, right, are getting, like you said, PO hydral one day and then IV labetalol the next day, and they're sort of like, that IV didn't work, let's try something else.
Right.
All right. So next, you guys looked at your different subgroups, just to kind of remind everybody what those were. So the age groups of less than 75 or greater than or equal to 75 years old, either frail or not frail, the outpatient blood pressure, which, like you mentioned, because it's the VA, it's nice that we, or like Swap mentioned, because it's the VA, it's nice that we're able to actually have that data, right? So the outpatient systolic of less than 140 versus greater than or equal to 140, a history of cardiovascular disease, and then the maximum systolic blood pressure within that first 48-hour period. And for those groups, it's less than 180 versus greater than or equal to 180. And for pretty much all of these subgroups, the results were consistent. So we still see increased risk in the intensively treated patients. The one thing I will point out here is the patients with the maximum systolic blood pressure of greater than or equal to 180 in the first 48 hours, the odds ratio of that primary outcome is 1.15, but the confidence interval, so we do see that cross one there. So it goes from 0.997 to 1.33. So that's really the only one where, even when we kind of stratify by these groups, we see that confidence interval cross one. So that's the one group that is maybe perhaps a little bit more questionable in terms of the results there.
Tim, what do you think? You got enough comparisons that you're going to get one of them that by chance falls there? And what do you think, there's a signal, real signal with this very high blood pressure?
I'm not sold that that's a particularly convincing signal. I mean, you're 90, you know, we talk about 95% confidence intervals. Your 94% confidence interval would call that statistically significant.
Yeah.
But that's like the Bayesian person in me wanting to like fight back against being super excited about p-values of 0.05 and all the like. This study does not answer the question of, you know, what do we do exclusively in people with a really, really, truly high blood pressure that's persistent. But I think I think that the potential for, if that's managed right, and probably not with IVs, but with orals, and somebody who truly has high blood pressure at home, has super high blood pressure in the hospital, should we be doing something about it, is unsettled. And I think not answered by a study like this, where that only makes up a couple percent of the population.
Yeah, I think that's the key point, though, right? It's underpowered, potentially. Like, it's still a huge study, so it's hard to say underpowered, but it may be with all of the weighting and everything else.
They had 13,000 people with blood pressures greater than 180. It's a big, right? 5,000 and 8,000?
Yeah, for an RCD, that would be a large number, true. Yeah. When I admit patients, we use this trick where a senior colleague told me that PAGE-MD, or we say give clonidine 0.1, because that's the, we don't use hydralazine, we use clonidine more, when BP more than 200 over 120, say, you know, I'm picking a high number. And that's sort of psychologically, you can't tell a nurse, you know, don't page us if the BP is 160. But when you say page us if the BP is so and so, what happens is they get nudged that if the BP is less than that, they say, oh, the doctor doesn't want to know. So they don't page us. So that sort of helps in reducing. But I'm wondering if that number should be maybe 180 over 110 or I don't know. What do you do, Tim, right? Do you actually treat numbers at all, or you don't treat high numbers in your practice?
I mean, I feel like a blood pressure at 220 still, I could only play that game of chicken to such a high number. But I think I still try to go back to that sort of, you know, is it actually 180 more than once? Like, if you actually go back and it's measured correctly and you kind of go through those different steps. Because I've certainly seen, right, the person whose blood pressure is being drawn the same moment that they're getting their blood drawn, And you're like, well, like, sure, if it stabbed me with a needle and checked my blood pressure in the same arm that you're stabbing me with a needle, like, that'll come right back down 30 points the next second.
One of the other interesting things that we talked about, we said that about 20% of the cohort was in the got exposed to the intensification of blood pressure. But if you look at people with blood pressures greater than 180, it's 40% of people get that blood pressure. So you can see behavioral changes. Doctors are much more likely to do it. So it's a 40-60 split rather than a 20-80 split. It's different.
And I do want to push back, though, to your number before, Joel. Joel, you mentioned that 13,000 people had a blood pressure over 180, and I don't see that anywhere. It was 5% of the cohort.
I'm just looking at, I'm looking at E-table 7, N of exposed to intensive blood pressure treatment, 5,326 greater than or equal to 180, and N not exposed to the treatment, 7,913. I'm looking at E-table 7 on page. There's no page numbers.
There's no page numbers.
I don't know what to tell you. Yeah, no, but I see what you're saying. Okay.
To Tim's point, too, it's kind of when I think one of the big questions that everyone has is when do you kind of stop playing this game of chicken and decide that it's really time to treat, like when is too high risk, even if it's asymptomatic, or is it ever too high risk? And I think where you start playing that game of chicken gets a little bit different for everybody. And then also to your point, this was a maximum systolic blood pressure in the first 48 hours, which is different than, you know, sustained systolic blood pressure over this number. If it's measured properly, if it's sustained, if their pain is well controlled, if like all of those things that are true of like a perfect blood pressure measurement, which is pretty much never going to be true in the inpatient setting, but to the extent that you can get, you know, if all of those things are true, that's different than just one kind of maximum systolic blood pressure greater than 180, which I think oftentimes we've all also had that call where it's, you know, 182 and then they check it again in an hour and it's 160 and we say, great, we didn't do anything. You know, it's coming down because of whatever reason, either they're less anxious or their pain is treated or they're resting or what have you. So I think that's the other thing to your point is that, is it sustained? And then where do we kind of stop playing that game of chicken?
So how do we actually want to measure blood pressure in patient that would actually be worth treating is the other question. I mean, is there actually, there's no guidance for this, right? Is there really a way to check a good blood pressure? I've definitely gone around looking at inpatient blood pressure devices in a few circumstances, finding ones that are not validated devices to begin with. Do we trust what we're even getting in terms of the number in the first place, not to mention like what position is really right? Like, how do you get a person in an inpatient setting to a situation where their back is supported, their legs are flat on the floor without like having to get somebody who may not have gotten up from the bed in ages to get up to a chair? Then you've now had that person exert themselves. So you have to have them wait there and come back a half hour later. So I think there's just so many challenges and confounders to it. I recently was asked by our OBGYNs here my thoughts on how we should be checking blood pressures in women who have preeclampsia while they're in labor. And I responded with, well, when I was in labor, I had a blood pressure of 162 over 100, and someone tried telling me that I had that I had hypertension in pregnancy, and I started laughing hysterically, and then my blood pressure came down. So I just think there are a lot of challenges in general that we are not going to have an easy solution to. And so I don't think we should not check blood pressure. I like the point early on about how we're checking blood pressure often mainly to look for hypotension. But I think we need to reset our sort of expectations of that high blood pressure. I love Tim's framing of this as we should be thinking of it as an inpatient pulse.
I was waiting for somebody to argue for like art lines for everybody because, you know, that would solve our measurement issues. But
I was going to say, these...
So I had a fellow ask me recently, like, do we really trust art lines more than automated blood pressures in the hospital? And I'm like, well, it depends. I obviously so many reasons not to do that.
See, I was going to say, if you're going with the pulse comparison, when is your cutoff for when it's like, you know, SVT or a true arrhythmia versus just sinus tachycardia, you know? And I think that's the question that all of us have.
Yep.
Okay, we got two more tables that need to be covered, E table 8 and 9.
Look at Joel being a completionist.
And this is the sensitivity analysis that I didn't even mention in the methods.
Well,
they use the overlap weighting.
I just think the E-table 8 is kind of interesting because it's pretty interesting.
Mm-hmm. And so this is what they did was they looked at, the overlap weighting method was the primary method, but they also looked at unadjusted.
If they had, if they had used a different method.
If they used different methods.
If they had adjusted the data, if you will, a different form of hocus pocus, Jordy.
So propensity
score
matching.
Feeding the trolls.
Yes, it is.
I am the worst.
Or the inverse probability weighting also that Jordy had mentioned. So they looked at those methods and for the primary outcome, again, mostly similar.
Yeah, it's really
the
consistent, right?
It's slightly different, but with IPTV, it's a little bit 1.47. It looks a little bit higher. The number looks higher. I don't know if there's any significance to that.
I think of it as it should be good practice for journals that publish this sort of work to ask for something like this, because if you're seeing a lot of flips, then the idea of calling it a hocus pocus starts to resonate. Is if you have four different models and two are positive, two are negative, then, it's probably all spurious. But if you have consistency, I think that tells you a lot.
Yeah. And in E-table 9, you can see it is fairly consistent. Like some of the 95% confidence intervals now cross one or don't cross one. But, if you look at the point estimates and the spread, it is pretty overlapping. The inverse probability weighting numbers are slightly higher. And again, I don't know if that means anything. I'm just curious that is higher. But they're all consistent, right? It's not that there is harm in one analysis and there is benefit in the other analysis. They're all in the same direction.
Yeah, I would think of it as, so the matching tends to be lower power because you throw out a lot of people because you do a match. So often you have less, things are less statistically significant just because they're kind of underpowered. The IPW, I think of as what Jordy said before, you're trying to fixate on those really extreme people. And so if you're fixating in part on the folks on the extreme ends of the spectrum, you may draw kind of higher contrasts. Mm-hmm. But I wouldn't think of it as something that, it's reinforcing the fact that there's consistency, not that those small changes are clinically meaningful.
Tim, do we miss anything from the results? Anything else that we didn't cover? We covered everything. Okay.
Everything we could fit into 10 e-tables, 9 e-tables.
AC, any take-home messages or thoughts on the study?
I think the big take-home is that, I'm not sure that we should be kind of jumping, at least in the first 48 hours, to kind of treat these, these elevated blood pressures or this inpatient hypertension. But I think the big question for me, and we certainly shouldn't be using IV medication, barring kind of these special populations that we talked about or things like that. Although I think hopefully most of us have stopped doing that. But I think the big question for me is always going to be at what point, right? Because like you mentioned, right? Like for the patients with a systolic greater than 180, it's still is pretty close to looking like there's potential harm, in, at least in those first 48 hours. So I think the big question for me is always going to be, at what point do we kind of hit that cutoff where we say it's worth treating or there's benefit, or is there a point at all? But I think for me, this really shows, hey, there's not a lot of benefit, at least especially in those first 48 hours, to jumping the gun and treating. You're really not seeing, even to my mind, any clinically significant reduction in the numbers or in the blood pressure compared to when you're not really intensifying treatment. And then you're really just seeing harm.
Swap thoughts?
To expand on that, so I think we are all convinced. I love this study because it reaffirms what I think we should be doing.
Reaffirms your pride. Yeah, me too.
Yeah, it reinforced my practice. But, when I around my physician assistant and pharmacist roll their eyes when the topic of hydralazine comes up because I've ranted on it so many times. But residents still come with that teaching somewhere, right? And we talked about surgical floors. So I'm sure on the nephrology floor, perhaps it doesn't happen so much. But on many other floors in the hospital, this is happening. People are still using PRN hydralazine. They did not attend FJC. They did not read Tim's studies. So this is still happening. And I'm wondering about the implementation aspect. Is that what should we do and how should we do it to change practice?
And actually, that brings me to a question. I really wonder, did you consider looking at whether these were medical patients or surgical patients and see if there's a difference in behavior?
For this one, we didn't. I will say the hardest thing about doing this sort of study in surgical patients is actually that, at least in the VA, anesthesia records are the same set of vital signs as everything else. So all of a sudden, you'll get people who have like 200 blood pressures in the span of
two hours. Right.
And they actually get IV blood pressure medicines like intraoperatively, and it gets wonky. So that is it's a good question that is not well answered, but it's also a hard one to study, at least with this sort of observational data.
With this data. Got it.
Yeah. But Swap, to your point, there is a really nice study in the Journal of Hospital Medicine by Zach Jacobs, who's a hospitalist now at Oregon Health and Sciences, where they do a QI project that is basically turning off alarms and then educating nurses about particularly IV blood pressure meds. They didn't really focus on orals. And they track kind of reductions in use, but they also, to try to track the other side of it, they track whether there were more like kind of codes and critical care alerts and things, and found a reasonable sustained reduction in like a relatively low touch, like we won't let you turn on this alarm or this sort of like standard alarm, and we'll do like, you know, an hour of teaching with people. And so I do think it's implementable. I think that study was probably like better results than I would have guessed, because usually people don't listen to education, right? So I think it's possible, but it needs to be hammered home in medical education more and more.
But I think that drives home the key to all of this, is that we shouldn't necessarily be ignoring these blood pressures altogether. We should be educating nurses, because that was sort of where I started at, is it's always a well-intentioned nurse for a reason who's calling us, because she's learned these numbers are bad. And I don't think that we're going to get very far by just ignoring them entirely. AC brought this up, and this came up a few times in the conversation. We shouldn't just ignore high blood pressures. We should think about, are they real and what's the reason for them? Is this patient's pain adequately treated? Is this patient's anxiety adequately treated? Is their insomnia adequately treated? And sometimes we can cause harm, of course, by treating those things too much or in the wrong way. But I think we have to always think about the context and educate the nurse on why, not just hang up the phone and say, no, I'm not going to treat. And I could see the pendulum swinging too much in the opposite direction, where people sort of ignore blood pressures because they now know that treating them are harmful, and then not thinking at all in the other sort of big umbrella of what's happening. Not that that's definitely going to happen, but I just think it'll be really important for people to just think about the context and treat patients as multidimensional beings and treat our nurses as multidimensional beings who deserve an explanation.
And I've heard about people that wanted to implement similar QI projects or studies about not measuring or not treating these inpatient hypertensions and getting blocked by IRBs. When I heard this was years ago, like 5 or 6 years ago, before a lot of the current data that we have that really shows some of the harms of this. But I think these observational studies are super important for us to break through these IRBs, to get us some prospective data. You know, in the end, this bias by indication is problematic. Sicker patients are going to have these higher blood pressures. Sicker patients are going to, you know, the higher blood pressures can be risk factors for acute kidney injury and heart strain and all these other outcomes that you're looking at. And I think that it's reasonable to want prospective work data here.
I would also say, I know you're kind of talking about the, you know, educating people about when to call and things like that. But I think one of the things, just speaking of that I'd be curious to look at, probably I'm guessing is the person who was most recently a resident, is how many inpatient default order sets have it in there to call us when the blood pressure is over a certain amount. Because I bet you at so many hospitals, I mean, it's like call for a pulse less than this or greater than this, call for a blood pressure less than this or greater than this, call for, I think the only one that has like only one limit to it is the pulse ox, right? Where they're not going to call you for 100%, but they'll call you for less than whatever you set it to. But I bet you most of the inpatient, just like, you know, admission order sets that are standard that we just click on in Epic or whatever your EMR is, I bet you it has that in there. Mm-hmm. So I think it's also the question of, should those be taken out, or should we educate our house staff on taking those out? Or, you know, really educating them on when you get that call, really think about what's the underlying cause of that.
I worry about taking it out entirely, because again, we could miss the agitated patient that we only find out they're agitated because we get called with the blood pressure sort of scenario. There's a lot to that. Go ahead, Slot.
Yeah, no, again, the parameters could be set to 180, right? And the house staff are setting themselves up with the cascade. If you say call at this, then when you get called, you feel like an obligation to do something, right? You only are saying to get called, and you cannot say, oh yeah, I told you to call me, but I'm going to ignore that number. That doesn't feel right. So it's up to us to, you know, have a certain thing in mind. And, you know, maybe 180 is the right number, and not definitely not 140, maybe 160, maybe 180, at which you really want to go and assist the patient and see what's going on.
Yeah. And I think that's the other thing is that education, that assessment is an intervention, right? It doesn't necessarily have to be a medication, but going and assessing the patient, like you're saying, and figuring out what is causing this. Mm-hmm.
Tim, what are you thinking about? What do you want to investigate further after this study? Where are your questions? Where are your gray areas?
I'm not sold anybody's ever going to pay or cough up the many millions it would take to do like the perfect RCT of this, mainly just because, you know, the outcomes are rare enough in this small time people are in the hospital that you'd have to enroll like tens of thousands of people. Yeah. I'm interested still in this question of, you know, the person whose blood pressure is truly, you know, 160, 170 at home, who rides high in the hospital too, and you actually know this, like, you know, you have their outpatient records and you really know that they're running too high. It feels like there could be an opportunity there, like to get to your prior point, Jordy and Swap, about being at AHA hypertension and like, you know, missed opportunities for treatment. The question just becomes, how do you find the right person and how do you actually use hospitalization as that right time? Because you certainly get more time with patients, but you know, you're also some doc they don't know and they're eating weird food and they're scared because they have pneumonia and they don't want to die of their pneumonia. So like they probably don't care about their blood pressure. I grapple a lot with that idea that I don't want to totally dismiss the idea that the hospital could be a good place to intervene on blood pressure. And I think there's a lot to be done more interventionally trying to test out, you know, strategies to identify who that is who might benefit. And then, you know, try to think more about what's the 1 year, 2 year time horizon and stop thinking about like what's the 2 hour time horizon till I'm off shift.
Yeah. I mean, there are the patients that I follow either in my nephrology clinic or hypertension clinic. And if someone fiddles with their, you know, I'm very possessive about my patients. So if someone fiddles with them, like 160, 170, I'm like, I know what I'm doing, right? Don't do anything. But your point is right that I think it's fine if you don't do anything during the inpatient stay, as long as they get some outpatient follow up. And I think the biggest problem we have is a lot of people either don't have a primary care physician or someone to see them, right? And to do that assessment and tell them what needs to be done. That's the reason someone's blood pressure is uncontrolled often, is either that or, you know, all that data with the barber shop that, you know, they don't have enough trust in that system. So it's like use every opportunity to do something is the other end of the picture here. I don't know that I have an answer to your question is what I'm saying. It's a very good question.
Okay. Any other final thoughts on this? Jordy, did you get your piece?
Yeah. I had my pedestal.
Tim, congratulations. I think this is... You know, it's weird calling it practice changing just because it's retrospective, blah, blah, blah. But I think it is. I think we're seeing the pendulum change that thoughtful doctors are saying no to these IV antihypertensives and these PRN orders. And this body of literature is moving the needle forward. I think it's good for patient safety.
Kind words. I'm still down for the trial if somebody else wants to organize it, but just, you know, to overcome and be definitive.
Yeah, I'd love to see it too.
I think this is where pragmatic trials and these adaptive designs and some of these more electronic health record driven designs may have a home. And I could see a future for that happening in a study like this. I'm hopeful for that future.
Cool. Excellent. Okay, time for tubular secretion swap. What do you got?
Joel mentioned I wasn't here in the summer. I was doing a lot of driving. And then because there hadn't been any freely filtered podcast out, I started listening to ebooks. I've never listened to audiobooks. And this was the first time I said, okay, let me listen to audiobooks. And I started listening to, there's a series by John Scalzi who writes science fiction books called the Dispatcher. And they're narrated by Zachary Quinto. Yeah. So the Dispatcher is someone who, this is a universe where if you murder someone, 5 seconds later, they wake up in their own bed alive at home.
Like a video game?
You have to read it. Yeah, yeah. So if you die a natural death, then you die. But if you get murdered, you don't die. So the dispatcher is somebody who actually, if something has gone wrong, for example, in a surgery, there has been a complication. So they call the dispatcher, he shoots them or he kills them and they wake up pre-surgery. Yeah, so you avoid the complication, right? You're back alive. Things like that. So it's there are a bunch of books and they're very cool. So if you haven't, if you have time, you listen to audiobooks, the Dispatcher series from John Scalzi.
Okay. Dispatcher series by John Scalzi. Great, great author. One of my faves for science fiction. AC, what do you got?
I have been reading a book called A Heart That Works, which is a book that my sister actually recommended to me. I don't know if any of you guys have read it, but it's by Rob Delaney, who one of the main characters in the show Catastrophe.
He's a funny guy.
He's a really funny guy. He's a really funny guy. And he actually, I didn't know this, but he lost a child to brain cancer. And so my sister recommended it to me because she had read it and said it was upsetting, but really good. And I think it helped her. She felt like it kind of helped her relate to what I do on a day-to-day basis. I don't treat kids with that, obviously, but just kind of understanding like what we all go through as a different type of caregiver. But and he's really funny. Like even in the book, it's kind of really impressive, but he just talks about like going through this with his wife and his family and coping with this. And it's a really interesting read. Sad, but very, very interesting and actually very funny. And so I recommend it to anybody that hasn't read it.
Excellent. Tim, what do you got?
So I'll keep with the audiobook theme. So I moved from Boston to Pittsburgh and had to drive two cars separately on that 10-hour drive. For folks who have never been to the lovely city of Pittsburgh, it's sometimes colloquially referred to as the Paris of Appalachia, because it's the big city of Appalachia. And so I listened to Demon Copperhead, which is like the Barbara Kingsolver novel that I think won some fancy awards. But the key piece is the audiobook. So that whole book is about like a fictional account of, in part, the opioid epidemic in Appalachia. But the audiobook narrator has such an amazing Appalachian accent that it like transports you to where you are in a way that reading it on paper just would never work. Highly, highly recommended.
Nice. Excellent. So the name of the book one more time is?
Demon Copperhead.
Demon Copperhead.
In a way, a modern opioid-inspired retelling of David Copperfield.
Excellent. Excellent. Jordy, what do you got?
Yeah, I actually read a book. I read The Anthropocene Reviewed, which I strongly recommend. It's fantastic for people dealing with a little bit of chaos in their life because it's a series of nonfiction essays by an author named John Green, who was the author of The Fault in Our Stars. He's mostly known actually for doing, I believe, a YouTube series with his brother, Hank Green, or Hank Green does SciShow and John Green does this YouTube series with Hank. And it's a really great deep dive into different scientific topics and different anthropologic topics. Anthropocene is the name for the era in which humans affected like the environment, the climate, and all the world around us. And so he goes through and does Amazon reviews of all different aspects of the Anthropocene, including things like Dr. Pepper and just like humanity. It's pretty like tongue-in-cheek, but also gets very serious. He has a history of obsessive-compulsive disorder, some severe bouts of depression in the past, and he had tried to work as a hospital reverend, and that failed miserably due to some sad things that he witnessed. So it's got some downsides, but some other very, very hilarious and very interesting sides, and I learned a lot reading it.
It was a podcast first, and you can still hear the Anthropocene Reviewed podcast. I would highly recommend it. It's really, really high quality stuff. He reads his own stuff. Yeah, not the first John Green mentioned in Freely Filtered. We did Turtles All the Way Down a number of years ago. Excellent. So I, at the end of August, did a hiking trip in the Dolomites, which is a hiking park in northern Italy. It's absolutely spectacular. It is highly accessible in a way that I've never seen a park. It's like a ski resort during the winter. So there's gondolas that run all the time. So you can get from the bottom of the mountain to the top of the mountain, then hike all the way down or around there for a couple of hours. There's restaurants all over the place up there. It is a completely different vision for what it means to be a hiking park than in the United States. Highly focused on accessibility. So we were out for 8 days straight and we would be going past toddlers because they were just took the gondola up that morning. It was really different. And so if you are into hiking and you want to get a different view on what it can be like, I recommend the Dolomites in northern Italy. Okay, great. Thanks, guys. This is great.